I think growing our food has this huge potentiality to open our hearts to become empathetic for, you know, what we're eating, who and how it was grown.
Hello, and welcome to the Inner Green Deal podcast, where we talk to inspiring guests about the human dimension of sustainability and explore the link between our personal journeys and the positive impacts we can have on the world. My name is Tamsin Walker. This month, as we find ourselves in the thick of the festive season, a time of year where food itself becomes a guest at the table, we're going to explore what goes into getting it there. To shed some light on this expansive issue, I'm talking to someone deeply immersed in growing food. Originally from Ireland, Mick McAvoy lives, works, and studies at the Plum Village Buddhist community in southwestern France. There, he mindfully manages the Happy Farm, which grows seasonal organic food for the community and hundreds of people who travel there each year to take part in retreats. He's also responsible for a sprawling rewilding project with minimal human intervention. Hello, Mick, and welcome.
Thank you so much, Tamsin.
All right. I would like to kick this off by talking about place and in particular, a place that held fondness for you when you were growing up. And I wonder, given your connection to the natural world, if maybe there were such a place for you in the great outdoors.
Mm. Yeah. It's funny. Where I am at, in this moment, I'm back in Ireland and I'm visiting family for Christmas. It's actually the house that I grew up in. When I look out the window, it's very much suburban now, but I can still see the fields. So we were at the edge of town. We still are. A small little town in Ireland, Northern Ireland, called Oma. And the place that comes to mind with that question are the small country roads that weave through the very much agricultural land. But there's an old ring fort. And these are really common on the landscape around this part of Ireland. So these were homesteads. What we see now is just this remnant of native species of woodland trees. So you would have oak and ash, sometimes crab apple and holly. The people who lived there, they brought their animals in to be protected from essentially what was cattle rustling or the theft, because cattle and cows were the currency.
Okay.
And I can see it. I can see this old ring fort now. So there's memories of time spent exploring bluebells and primroses, and they pepper the landscape.
That's really beautiful. So a ring fort, is it buildings as well, or is it purely woodlands?
There probably would have been buildings. Those buildings are now long gone.
Oh, well, thank you for sharing that. That sounds very rich in terms of a memory, but also still there for you to look at today. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned in the introduction, you manage the farm at Plum Village. Mm. And I'm wondering, how did you get from Ireland to doing that job, both in terms of the farming itself, but also the move?
Mm. Yeah, I think it all began, you know, what I mentioned there, those little roads with the beautiful hedgerows and the wild plants. And then the little garden that's still here in my family home with my mom's beautiful gardener. I think that seed of love of plants and of nature was planted early in my childhood, which I'm really grateful for. And like many people, it took me a long time to find my passion or, you know, my deepest heart's desire. It took me, I think, until I was around 25. So middle class upbringing, fortunate to access to university education, but that was in real estate, which is so far away. I don't know how I got there, but I got there. And eventually I finished my university degree, but I was I didn't know what direction to go. But I followed that sort of volition or intuition to want to be outdoors and to be with the natural world, and especially with plants. So I got really fortunate, and I did a 3-year apprenticeship with the National Trust, which is an amazing charity, minimum wage, but with very little responsibility. And just constant learning and beautiful gardens. And for there, many doors and opportunities opened over the decades after. So I continued to work with plants professionally. I worked in Kew Gardens in London. I got chances to travel West China, Tibet, New Zealand, Australia, to Southeast Asia to look at plants growing in their natural habitat.
Gosh.
So after some time doing that, I ended up going towards the skills of cultivating food, because one thing that we all do, at least I hope once a day, if not more, is eat. And it dawned on me that I think we're probably the first generation of humans that have been severed from this ability to cultivate our own food.
Yeah.
So I came back to Ireland and I spent 5 years working with a charity here to bring together the growing and cooking of foods and the sort of slow and hopefully gentle and respectful building of communities. And in that time, I was starting to go back and forth to Plum Village, because in 2012, I was really lucky to go to a 1 week retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh, Thai as we call them in Plum Village, which means teacher. And I started to go on retreat once a year and then maybe twice a year. And it was at the second visit that I discovered that some friends had started this little project, the Happy Farm.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I always loved my work, I felt that maybe the monastic path was something that could be for me in Plum Village. But it took me around 4 or 5 years to answer that question about monastic life. And I firmly have answered, and it's put that to the side. But what happened at that same time was this opening to step in to care for and develop the Happy Farm project, which is also now a wider project of rewilding around 30 acres. So I found a niche in the community, and I'm not a monastic, but sometimes I describe myself as half farmer, half monk.
Half farmer, half monk. I'm really interested to dig into the subject of food with you. But before we get there, you talked a little bit about the community, and I'm wondering about the process of farming in a Buddhist community. I know that you've written about connection and about reconnection with the land, for example. Would you say that when it comes to growing food, that the idea of being connected with the land is part of the approach of the Happy Farm?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. How we used to introduce what we did, you know, the words that we used to introduce what we were doing on that land have evolved. So it used to be organic and organic farm. And then for a few years, we used the term regenerative farming. And now what fits best is, I believe, is the term agroecology. So I think that speaks to the connection of the land. So we have that care of the lands, but also one element is the human connection. And what makes it a little bit different, I think, in my mind, our project is this gift of not having a commercial pressure, where we don't have to fill a couple of vans to drive to a market, or we don't have to worry about, you know, the overhead. So that gives us space to focus on the human relationship. So we use the term family, which is, you know, could be a little bit contrived, but we try to genuinely cultivate the spirit of family. So we have people who come for a year or volunteer for maybe at least a minimum of 1 month in the summer. You know, I'm not evangelical about Plum Villages or even Buddhism. You know, I'm open to all the beauty of all the wisdom traditions and indigenous traditions on this planet. But there's something powerful about the Plum Village space and the human community. But I think it begins with individuals coming and being open to knowing that they need to give themselves time, need to give themselves space. I've been honored to see countless examples of transformation in people's lives. Two things I think are a big part of it, or maybe three, is the connection with the natural world, and then that human connection as well. You know, Thay and many others talk about loneliness. We know that from even organizations like the World Health Organization. And here we have in Plum Village, a beautiful opportunity to develop and experience meaningful human connection in our daily lives. So we have these beautiful opportunities, just like so many ancestral traditions, where we sit in circle, share and listen to one another. There's no hierarchy of spirituality. People come with their humanity, and often our own experiences will resonate with somebody else who's maybe coming through a challenge, or we can, somebody else shares some joy or happiness in their life, and maybe that, like a domino effect, can make somebody realize there's elements that they can be grateful for in their lives.
I've yet to visit. Mm-hmm. It'll happen one day.
You'd be welcome.
I wonder if you can paint for listeners a picture of the farm. You know, what does it look like? What do you grow there?
Yeah. So it's sort of this term agroecology that I mentioned. It's the two components of that word, agriculture and ecology. On one side, we were surrounded by this beautiful oak woodland, and then we have this lovely lotus pond and this wet woodland with a stream. So that's surrounding us, hugging the farm. Mm-hmm. And in the farm, it's 1.5-2 acres. 70% of that land is in cultivation, but the agroecology piece means that we intentionally leave parts uncultivated and wild. So there's many areas of meadow, wildflower meadow, some that we never cut, some that we'll cut on a 1-year cycle, some on a 2 or 3 year cycle. Mm-hmm. And then we have, a focus on a mixture of perennial crops and fruit and annual crops. So for me, it's sort of a rich tapestry. There's these long linear beds. Often we'll cultivate 2 or 3 crops in one summer. So in one bed. So if you imagine 30 meters and 1.2 meters wide of garlic. And after midsummer, we'll harvest our garlic and we'll maybe put a couple of crops of salad and lettuce. And then when they come out in early autumn, maybe we'll put some winter vegetables like leek that will go through the winter and give us that harvest. So there's a continuity of cultivation. Yeah, as well as the plants and the landscape, you'll see a lot of humans. So we intentionally don't use a lot of machinery. We maybe have a lawnmower and a strimmer that we use sometimes, but a lot of it is done with the power and the muscle of the people. So it's a productive farm, but we've also put in a beautiful wooden deck where people can come and relax. And there's a beautiful old oak tree that hangs over to provide shade. So sometimes people are there reading or journaling, doing yoga. We've nice little benches to hang around at. People come down and take shade by the edge of the lotus pond in the summer.
It sounds amazing. So inviting. And I can picture the beds. And that would take us on to food and our relationship to food. I also grew up where my parents had a small holding. They grew a lot of their own food and regularly pointed onto the plates. This is homegrown, this is homegrown. And I have to say, as a teenager, probably I would have rather had a slice of white bread or something. But, I value it in a very different way now. And I wonder, how do you think growing your own food has the power to change the way that you interact with what is on your plate?
Yeah, I remember a friend, I used to work with a charity here in Ireland called Grow It Yourself that empowered people to grow their food. And my friend had this beautiful saying that with all the busy modern life and all the webs of our global economy and community, our food cultures can be really rich in some parts of the world, but for many of us, there's an apathy in our food. We don't pause to think about the pre-prepared salad or the sandwich that we might buy from the gas petrol station or the supermarket. And I think with what can happen for most people when they start to cultivate even a little bit of their own food, it could be some arugula, rocket salad, and a window box, is that they can sort of shift that apathy to a sense of empathy. So from food apathy to food empathy, to be completely empathetic with the food that is there on their plate or in their bowl, and then maybe more conscious and aware of the processes and the time and energy for the humans, the farmers, the growers that have grown the food that's going to nourish them, give them the energy, give them the nutrition. But also, hopefully, slowly, then there's so many layers to see not just who grew the food, but how it was grown in terms of the sadness of the modern industrial food system. Mm-hmm. For sure, it feeds the world in a way, but also there's so many casualties along the way, human and more than human. I think growing our food has this huge potentiality to open our hearts to become empathetic for what we're eating, who and how it was grown. And I like this idea that we practice in one village every day, the practice of eating meditation. We'll eat in silence for 20 minutes. Often people will hold their bowl in their hands and look and see the components. Maybe there's rice, maybe there's pasta or potatoes, broccoli or kale. And to see the connection to sun and soil, the sky, the rain, the farmer, all of it. And it's a powerful practice to uproot this notion of a separate self, which is a lifetime's work. And often I sit there thinking about my projects, completely unaware of what's in my bowl. So it's not, you know, like it's a perpetual stream of awareness. Often I go into autopilot and become disconnected.
And I was going to ask you about that, because for people who are very steeped in busyness, they have the habit of going to the shop, perhaps at lunchtime, buying a sandwich, taking it back to the desk, eating the sandwich at the desk, and which is a relationship of sorts with food, but it's not the kind of empathetic relationship that you're talking about there. Do you have a suggestion for how to perhaps even just momentarily break free from that autopilot?
Yeah, it's the reality. Like, not everybody lives in the countryside where we are in the south of France, in a practice center where week after week we have these conditions of, you know, a mindfulness practice, or even the time to stop. But it's really great if you can make a commitment. I think even if you have 15 or 20 minutes to step away from devices would be great. One part of life that I emphasize as much as possible in Plant Village is to have a nature connection in every day of your life. And many of us live in cities, so that can be hard. So if you have a chance to maybe take your lunch, or you need to go out to buy your lunch, if you're in the city, if there's a small green space or a park where you can go to and find a quiet space on a bench, or if you have to be in the building, in the office, is there a view? Can you orientate yourself to sit and have a view out, maybe even if it's just a street with a few trees on it, so that you can see some component of the natural world? And then that pause to look to see what are the component parts of whatever it is that you're about to eat, and have that sense of inquiry about where they came from, what were the conditions that made it possible for that to be there in your hand at that moment. Mm. Intention, I think, is a big part of it. Intention to even pause and awareness. So maybe one bite, one moment of tasting.
One bite. Yeah, I'll take that. Mm-hmm. You mentioned also where your food comes from, but it is really super difficult, I think, for people to go to the shop, buy a bag of pasta, and have any kind of understanding of how it got there.
Mm. So as I shared earlier, that disconnect for the first time probably in the history of humanity, where we've been severed from this, not just the sort of the skills to cultivate our own food, but even it's not visible if we're in the city, it's outside the city, obviously, or in a different country. So I empathize, but I think cooking is a big part of it as well, learning to cook. And if you want to cook, you want to probably eat well, serve good quality food for your loved ones, family, friends, community. And then we realize in a way that we have a lot of power as consumers. We can support resilient local food economies, growers and farmers, as well as other processors and people that sell it onward.
Yeah.
I love cookbooks. And to see those images of not just the food that's grown and cultivated, but how it ends up. I love to eat. There's a lovely saying, if you eat, you're in. So it can be nice to just slowly trace it back. We don't need to know everything about the pasta, but with that empathy as well, sometimes it's nice even to think of the people that drove the huge lorries to the back of the supermarkets to offload.
Mm. Talking about cooking, this is obviously a time of year where people could well be seduced into buying more food than they might necessarily need. And so that makes it a time that's quite rife with potential for food waste. Do you see a correlation between a trend to food waste and a shift away from us as vast societies getting our hands dirty and witnessing the process of food growing?
I do, and I take some hope. You know, in the recent COP28, I was in Dubai. Obviously, we need to go a lot further, but the first time where food was really, and agriculture was brought into it, the modern food system that I grew up with, it fed the world. But all of our ancestors, regardless of where we are on this planet, were farmers, whether that was in a small scale for their own families or communities. So the system, you know, it's a man-made system, this industrial food system, with all the waste that you talked about, all for profit. So, you know, I'm not going to bash capitalism, or we all need to eat. And it's amazing that we can experience so many different food cultures by going to our market or supermarket from all over the world. So it's given many gifts. But it's a really challenging system. For me, there's something about this movement of going back to the land, you know, in the global south. It's still the old ways of growing our food with very small amount of waste that is the dominant model of agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's often done by women, and taking back this term, and I share this term with respect because I use it for myself, this idea of a peasant farmer, the simplicity of a farmer. And for me, it's important to reclaim the nobility of what it is to work with the soil and work with the land. And when we do that, we're much more aligned with using everything that we can to minimize our waste.
Mm.
So I think it's a system that's man-made, but I take hope that it can also be unmade. But man, we don't need to recreate the wheel.
Mm. Well, there's one other thing I really want to talk to you about, and that's soil, because it is a little bit maligned, you know, the stuff that's on the bottom of your shoes or the stuff that's in your fingernails if you have been planting something. But I remember hearing an insect expert saying, if you just pull back the grass on a 1 square centimeter of ground and have a look at what's going on there, then it is cinematic. There's so much to see. And I think that if you dig a bit deeper down, then it must become yet more cinematic. So I just wonder, could you give us a little insight into what is happening in a small patch of soil in order for that food that you grow to make it onto our plates?
Yeah, I love that term, cinematic. That's really beautiful. I'll start by saying I'm not a soil scientist. I don't understand the depths of this beautiful mystery that is happening in the soil 100%, and I never will. In a way, I don't feel I need to. But what I sort of share when people come, what speaks to me with your question is, yeah, this reverence for life. And what we do on our little farm, which isn't unique to our farm, is this concept of no digging or no tilling. So we don't turn the soil over, we don't rotate it. So we sort of build it by layers, and there's many things happening there. Vandana Shiva, the amazing Vandana Shiva, shares the most important thing we can do at this time in the world with our human lives that we have is to start a garden, a vegetable food garden, and to become soil builders. So we see ourselves as soil builders in Plum Village, the Happy Farm. And yeah, what is happening? We don't dig, we don't turn, we don't invert. And there's a reason for that, because there's so much life in that soil. Just as you said, this cinematic experience when you pull back. One of my favorite words is mulch. So it's any organic matter that we cover the living, breathing soil with. It keeps the moisture in the ground when it's hot. It keeps it's like a sun cream, keeps it from being burnt, keeps it from being blown away if it's dry. And what we use is wheat straw from a local friend. It decomposes and feeds the soil. So yeah, what's decomposing it, what's eating it is this, yeah, there's just such a diversity of life, bacteria. We have, of course, the earthworms that are coming up and weaving their way and chomping, eating some of the debris and, you know, leaving their offerings to enrich the soil and opening it up with spaces and air. We have just unbelievable sort of diversity of all insect life and human life. But we also have, which is great now, this awareness of the fungal kingdom. So these treads of mycelia that are there. Some are visible and some are not. And sometimes we'll see these beautiful blooming of mushrooms, toadstools, whatever, the fungi, which is just the fruiting part of the plant, and the rest is under subterranean, under the ground. And they're decomposing a lot of the residue of the plants that have been cultivated on that bed and that soil before. Decomposing, making them available to all the other elements of life and the plants that we'll plant, that nutrition becomes available. So it's just this layer upon layer upon layer. I feel it's like a dark and beautiful mystery, like a never-ending ballet or cinema experience.
It's amazing.
One thing to share is that in America, and some friends, they use the word, and I don't try to judge, but just use the word interchangeable with soil, dirt. And for me, that's a challenge. When I hear that, I challenge people to think of the language we use and Is dirt appropriate, the aspect of reverence for life? Because for this soil, it's the origin of all the edible food that will take off this farm for the human community. And you know, the farmer is just one small part of the sort of the process. We cultivate things from seeds, we look after them, and eventually we'll plant them, but then we step away. So it's the soil that nourishes, then maybe we rely on pollinators to pollinate our tomatoes or our pumpkins. And you know, there's another nice mantra, feed the soil and the soil feeds the plants. So just trust the soil, trust the wisdom of the planet.
Oh, that's really beautifully put. I mean, obviously we are nothing without soil. We don't have a way to feed ourselves if we can't grow anything, and we can't grow anything if we don't have soil. But it just seems so incredible, so unrealistic that we sometimes just don't perceive ourselves to be part of the natural world, that it is just there in service to us, but that we fail to recognize the blindingly obvious. Yeah, soil just seems like such a great place to start.
That's at the center, I think, Tamsin, of everything. So I share every time I can when we welcome people to the farm that, thank goodness, things are shifting again, at least in the global north, where people can go to volunteer, to maybe live close to farms like the farm that we have in Plum Village. And to learn some of the skills of growing food. But what makes our project a little different is the raison d'etre is this invitation to remember that how Thay expresses it quite beautifully, Thich Nhat Hanh shares that we are the earth that carries us. So we try to uproot the notion of a separate self. And Thay coined the phrase interbeing, and it's there all over the natural world, the simple reciprocity of the plant kingdom producing oxygen for us to breathe, and we breathe out the CO2, the carbon dioxide, for them to build and consolidate their living systems. Poet and farmer Wendell Berry talks about, in a poem, the man born to farming, he talks about the sunlight lying down in the dung heap only to rise again in the corn. So that's that energy of what was a waste product from the cattle going on to enrich the fields and the soil for the crops that will nourish the humans in the season the next year.
I'm thinking probably you are on the same page as Vandana Shiva then, that the most important thing we can do is to have a garden.
Yeah, start a garden, do it with other people. And I love that, building the soil, loving and caring for the soil, custodians of the soil.
But does it also apply to a window box?
Totally. It's not about scale. It's not about one day being like having that homestead, or it's about, yeah, I think shifting from that, like I mentioned before, that food apathy towards food empathy. Window box, some people are growing, you know, microgreens or even sprouting, you know, in those little jars that you can sprout this super food, so super packed full of nutrition. So it's awakening to that sort of miraculous cycle of food cultivation. It's all in us. You know, we don't have to scratch it too far back a couple of generations. We're farmers, we're growers.
I'd like to end with a question that I put to everybody on the podcast, and that is this question. If there were one skill that you were able to bestow upon everybody in the world, what would it be?
Yeah, I think the answer is clear for me. Many people have taught me and shared the gifts of cultivating food. And in some way, maybe it'd be cheeky and sneaky too. But yeah, the skill I would want everyone in the world to be bestowed with, to be offered, reconnected with, this gift to cultivate some of our own food. And the second element is sort of unconscious, and that will be that when we do that growing of our food, we are also reconnecting with the natural world, remembering that we are the natural world. We are the earth that carries us. And in some way, hopefully, awakening from that false notion of a separate self, awakening to the reality of interbeing in daily life and this web of reciprocity and connection with natural world and the more than human family. So the simple art of the noble art of growing, you know, it's, it can be looked on as the poor peasant farmer, uneducated, you know, toiling in the fields in bad weather and hot weather and cold weather and the wet. But it's the most noble thing that we can do is to reconnect with the skills of growing and cultivating our own food to nourish ourselves and others, the human and more than human world, waking up.
Thank you so very much for sharing all of that.
No, not at all.
I hope you enjoyed listening to Mick as much as I enjoyed talking to him. Our conversation has left me with plenty of food for thought, and indeed thought for food, which I shall endeavour to take with me to the family table during the holiday festivities, but also beyond, remembering to start with just one bite. I'll be back early next year with a new episode of the Inner Green Deal podcast. For now, though, I invite you to share, subscribe, or scroll through the archives, which contain many interesting conversations with people working on sustainability and inner development. And I wish you a peaceful and restful end to this year and a good start to 2024. I look forward to you joining me again very soon. Bye-bye.